KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 19th year of the Portland Revels. The Portland Revels will perform 11 shows between December 6th and December 15th. That's the Portland Revels, December 6th to the 15th at the Scottish Rite Center in downtown Portland. More information about the show can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
What we're going to do is throw a lot of banana peels around Chicago and have the machine stumble.
I had a dream that the only reason the employers were so powerful was that we were weak.
There's this myth that black people did not resist until Watts or until the Black Panther Party. It's just not true.
Tune In, Turn On, and Remember is a monthly special program on the history of KBOO Community Radio, commemorating KBOO's 45th anniversary year. The last installment of this special series will be on December 24th at 6 p.m. And listen online to the full series at kboo.fm/tunein/turnon.
This is KBOO Portland, where the time is approximately 9:03 a.m. Coming up, host Joe Uris interviews filmmaker and former Portlander Penny Allen about her feature film, Late for My Mother's Funeral, about European and North African politics. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints features the latest on protests of the police killing of teen Andy Lopez in Santa Rosa, California. And at 11, on The Digital Divide, host Rabia Yeaman speaks with Kelly Roy, director, and Seamus Hawley, Shopmaster at ADX, where high-profile designers work alongside students and retirees and share their knowledge. Thanks, KBOO members, for supporting KBOO Community Radio. If you are not a member, you can become one when you go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
Hey, we're here.
So, coming up next this morning, Joe Uris speaks with filmmaker and former Portlander Penny Allen about her latest film, Late to My Mother's Funeral, and about European and North African politics. Penny Allen's film, Late to My Mother's Funeral, screens at 7 p.m. this Monday, December 16th, at the Witzel Auditorium at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue, Portland. Here's host, Joe Uris.
Hey, we're here with Penny Allen, who is a citizen of France and a citizen of the United States and a filmmaker and an amazing artist. And I want to welcome you to the States.
Thank you very much, Joe.
So you're here to present one of your films.
Right. My new movie.
Mm-hmm. And it's Late for My Mother's Funeral.
Right. Yeah.
Now, what's that all about?
Well, it's not about my mother. It's about the enigma of absence of this mother of 10 children in North Africa, Moroccan family living in Algeria. This is a real family. These are real people. And she was a notorious smuggler, not of drugs, but of gold and emeralds. And that is how she raised her 10 children alone. And she has died. And so I appeared on the scene with her son not too long after her death. And we filmed basically what was their grief and their grieving process, which is actually somewhat celebratory as well as sad. There's plenty of sadness in it, but it's much more like a wake in the sense that it's celebratory.
I think that most people in the United States, and certainly most people here in the Northwest, don't know much about North Africa. In fact, I think we have a mysterious, superficial, almost cartoon-like idea about the Islamic world. And I want to address that as well as your film. I hope you don't mind.
No, I think that would be a good idea as background. It's necessary.
So, first of all, I hope people know that North Africa was dominated by the European powers in the late 19th and through most of the 20th century.
Right.
And that Algeria was
was French.
Was literally part of France in an effort by the French to make legitimate their occupation of that country. It was also an enormous source of agricultural products and other wealth for the French nation.
Right. And for 130 years, it was a Department of France. And then it all came to a very brutal and cruel ending finally in 1962 when independence was won. But it was a war that, you know, that France, even today, I would say, has not really recovered from. You know, they've recovered from it a lot. But one of the things that happened after the independence was that at least a million people who had been French people who had been living in Algeria came to France. They're called the Pieds Noirs, the Black Feet, and they were not welcomed by the French citizens. So there was that schism, and then later on, the president of France, Giscard d'Estaing, created an executive order which was the regrouping of families so that all of the Algerian, essentially men, young men who were in France doing labor, were allowed to bring their families in. And so it was the kind of opening the floodgates for Algerians to come to France. And now Algeria has a 12% population largely from Algeria, Morocco, or 12% Muslim population.
Also about that same time, there was a right-wing resistance movement in France that was outraged at the abandonment, as it was seen, of Algeria. And I believe there was, in that right-wing movement, there were bombings and terror acts by French against France.
Right, in France. And actually, you know, some of it was went on while I was even a student there, and I wasn't even aware that it was happening, which is amazing how it could be kept quiet and kept secret. I only learned about that much later. But yes, it was a violent separation or rupture between Algeria and France, and much resented by many parts of the French citizenry. And you're right, there were violent incidents, and I would say that there's a part of that group that continues to this day.
Is it part of the Pen, Marie Pen, etc. movement?
Le Pen and the Front National, the far right in France, mm-hmm. is quite anti-Algerian, quite anti-immigrants in general. Did they grow? Did her party, their party, grow out of that? Well, possibly, yes, somewhat.
I think this is something that Americans don't even begin to understand or embrace. That is the literalness of colonialism, the literal domination.
I think it's important to note, you know, how much of a foot France did have in the Arab world and in the Islamic world and in the Mediterranean in general, stretching all the way to Lebanon and Egypt and Libya, Tunisia and Morocco and Algeria, and so on, and also around the world. I mean, colonialism is a defining aspect of France, and post-colonialism is now a defining aspect, and is possibly what the country is struggling with right now. You know, France is having as many struggles economically and socially as perhaps the United States, but it's a result. It's a post-colonial struggle.
I see this in the context of the American isolation from the realities of the cultures of Europe. And one of the reasons why I keep asking you about it is you're, for me at least, a person who's aware of some of this.
Well, I've been living in France now for 23 years. And you know, I had been there quite a bit before actually living there, even though, as I said earlier, I was in the dark about some of the darker sides of France at that time as a student. But I'm not now. And I have had the luck to live in quarters of Paris that have large Arabic or Arab populations. And by that I mean essentially Algerian. And for those who know about it, you know, and now I live in the, no Paris, I now live in the 18th arrondissement, which has a very large Arab population and also a very large Black population, because France also had its foot in Africa, in Black Africa. And now, of course, there is there has been for a number of years a flood of immigrants from Black African countries. And so I think you learn a lot simply by living in a certain area. And I certainly have many I would call them sources of information, who live in my arrondissement. And so whenever something happens these days, and it certainly happens a lot, like what something happens in Egypt, for instance, I go to someone and I say, well, what do you think about this? And we have a long conversation. So it's a way of being informed. And it's you're entirely right that it's outside of the domain of American thought. Americans essentially don't know very much about that at all. I think Americans' familiarity with North Africa is largely with Morocco as a tourist destination. And there's so much under the surface going on in Morocco that American tourists do not know about when they go there.
Well, coming back to your movie, Late for My Mother's Funeral, is it informed by and does it directly deal with these kinds of peculiar relationships between France and North Africa?
Well, it's a post-colonial movie, certainly, and it's largely because the 10 children of this incredible mythical woman, Zineb, are really torn between three countries. They're torn between Morocco and between Algeria and France. Most of them live in France now. Most of them live in Mâcon, which is part of Burgundy. And there's a very large Arab community in Mâcon. And are they integrated into the community? I would say no. They are not, and not they are. It goes both ways. They are somewhat excluded, but they also don't really want to be integrated into the community. And one of the sisters is much more integrated into the community, and she, as it turns out, is the sister who spent most of her younger years in Morocco.
Huh.
So Morocco is a country that is much more like the Western world, whereas Algeria is not. And so, yes, it deals with all of those questions, with identity and with the influence of political incidents that have nothing to do with a person, what the influence that those have on their lives later on.
Well, I'm thinking about this as a person who is very ignorant of North Africa and Africa in general. And I'm the role of Islam in all of this. And I was wondering, are you in a position to comment on the Islamic struggles that are going on in the Middle East at this time?
Well, sometimes yes, sometimes no. One of the things I did recently, just last week, before leaving to come here, was I was invited to the opening of the new center for, it's the Institut de Culture d'Islam, which is the Institute of Islamic Cultures. And it's maybe that would be frightening to most people, and they wouldn't think, what would I have to do there? But my movie did play there, actually, and to great success. It was a huge success. I'll talk about that later, because I want to answer your question. But anyway, I went, it's really interesting, because they're trying very hard to make the bridge between Islam and art, which is not usually done. And so it's a cultural center. And it was really great, because at this opening, there were hundreds of people from the neighborhood, and with all coming with great curiosity, Muslims, but also non-Muslims like myself. And it was a very mixed crowd, and everyone was having a great time. And, well, that was pretty thrilling to see everyone having a great time, in this mixed situation. And is that typical of, of France? I would say no. It's very advanced, and it's a wonderful example. But In terms of these kinds of issues in other countries, in North Africa and in the Mediterranean area in general, sometimes I have a fix on what is going on in a particular country, and then it changes so fast that you can't quite keep up. And for Syria, for instance, you know, people that I know went to Syria just before the current civil war exploded in Syria, and they had no inkling whatsoever that it was coming. They thought it was everything was quite stable, and so sometimes you don't really know what's going on. It's under the surface.
Well, I think Syria was always regarded in the United States as a secure ally.
Exactly. A secure country, a stable country.
Right.
Right. And but what is going on there is definitely a kind of civil war. And it's government and anti-government. I'm not so sure that you would call that a Sunni-Shia war. I don't think that's really what's happening at all.
I'm assuming that our audience knows a little, but not a lot, about Islam in general. Are you comfortable talking about the Sunni-Shia split? Can you make an analogy with the West?
Yes, I can. I'll make the analogy of wars that went on between Protestants and Catholics in Western history. And it's kind of like that. The two forms of the two dominant forms of Islam, the Sunnis and the Shia, are they will dominate in one country and then not in another, and that is what causes the tension between countries in that area. That is what's causing the tension between Iran right now and Saudi Arabia, for instance, and it's impossible for the West to intervene in that, quite frankly. And I think it's largely a mistake for the West to intervene in the Middle East in general. I was so glad that the American administration was forced to step back from some kind of a bombing attack or a missile attack in Syria, because It made everyone in Europe, made everyone I knew in Paris just aghast. You know, like, how could they do that? Who is it they're going to bomb? There's only about 100 different sectors or 100 different groups fighting each other there. Who is it that you're going to bomb? It would be a terrible mistake, and it would just escalate. Look what happened in Iraq. Now, that was a disaster of monstrous proportions, and it has left a country that still has plenty of violence.
Well, I think Iraq is a great example of American misfortune or misstepping, and it was all done, as far as I can tell, to the degree that I can tell, based on a mythic notion of American power coupled with a desire to control the oil in that region.
Yes, but also this strange excuse that U.S. foreign policy has tended to put forth, which is of getting rid of dictators. And, Gaddafi was a person of, certainly of mixed qualities. But one of the things that he did do was, create a fantastic educational system, and women were educated. And now the country is splintered into clan fights, into tribal fights. And it's very unstable. And Are they better off now without Gaddafi? It's hard to say. Is Iraq better off without having Saddam Hussein? Frankly, it's hard to say. And I think that Iraqis are very they're of mixed opinion on that subject.
Well, again, we see the United States in enormous ignorance, I think, stepping into situations looking purely at American goals, controlling oil, controlling land masses for larger geopolitical fantasies.
And the second one much more now,
really?
Than the oil. Well, because the United States is turning into a major oil producer.
Well, I think the United States is turning into, in fact, a natural resource producer in the world.
Rather than
an industrial nation.
Right.
Which I think is very odd.
It's very odd. But that means that the excuse of going after the oil is now quite secondary. And now it really has to do with what you said, the geopolitical issue and having allies and having friends. But in most of the cases where the United States has intervened, we went from having at least a known situation to a totally unknown and unreliable situation.
And I don't think I really don't think the United States utilizes, if it has it, good intelligence. That is to say, people who really are aware of what's going on in these various countries and of the complexity of what's going on. I think we do rely on an overarching notion about some vague fantasy of democracy.
Yes, and there, you have to ask, well, what is the reason that the United States in foreign policy should assume that democracy is something that will work in a particular country in the Middle East?
Well, and I also think, of course, that the notion of democracy as espoused by the United States is itself a fantasy.
Of course.
I mean, you know, we have a ruling class. We have a 1% that control the wealth of the country. How is that democratic?
Well, it's not at all. And that's the irony of the situation. It's an irony that perhaps is not recognized by in the American public so much or even thought about. But it is very, very much thought about in Europe. The French, and whom I know the best in Europe, are extremely sophisticated. And so when the United States spouts some particular point of view about what might be best for the Middle East, you know, there's a tremendous uproar and ironic commentary. They are pretty, the French are, however, pretty supportive of the negotiations that are going on right now in Iran, mm-hmm. or about Iran, about mm-hmm. the Iranian nuclear situation. They're quite positive about that. And they are also quite positive about the effort to create some kind of agreement and a two-country agreement in Palestine and Israel.
Well, you know, in the case of the former, there is right now a movement in Congress to reimpose various sanctions on Iran and to scuttle the agreements that seem to be close to it being achieved to bring Iran back into the world markets and the world's the general world politics.
Well, it's pretty much Republican based, and it's pretty much it's pretty ignorant, and people wanting to go back to neocon policies, and I mean it's just appalling as far as what I could say. I'm sorry.
But this the other struggle, the struggle which you tried to characterize as similar to the fights in a darker age between Protestants and Catholics, this struggle between Shia and Sunni has now become much more important because of the United States intervention in the region. It seems obvious to me that that what Saddam Hussein and his Ba'ath party did was forge a absolute unity among peoples who had, to a great extent, not so much in common culturally. It also seems to me that it's analogous to what happened in Yugoslavia.
Yes.
And when Tito died.
Tito died.
The same kind of thing broke out.
Yes, the lid was lifted off, and look what happened, a massive splitting apart. Well, yes, I think that's true, and it's probably what is going on to a certain extent in Syria right now. You know, what's his name, Assad,
mm-hmm.
is a dictator-like leader, and he has managed to hold together very dissonant groups.
And it's really, to me, an enormous puzzle that the U.S. Congress and generally the American leadership seems totally unaware and totally unsophisticated in dealing with the Middle East. That's, and dealing with all of the Islamic world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the a philosopher that named Michel Onfray in France that does a series on radio, France Culture every summer, every evening, he talks for an hour about what's going on in the world. And one of his issue this past summer, I didn't listen to it every day, of course, but people are frequently kind of glued to their radios at that hour just because he's so great. His issue this summer was to talk about the fact that we've had a various waves of cultural dominance in the world since in the last 2,000 years, and that we are now entering into the dominance of Islamic cultures. And for him to say that so strongly and then to talk about it for a whole summer, he had a huge influence. And also it was very, very informing. You know, all of us really learned a tremendous amount from him. But I happen to find it quite credible.
Really?
Yes, I do find it quite credible.
Well, what are the implications? Well, what are the implications for feminism then in an Islamic dominated world?
Silence from Penny.
Well, it's something to think about, you know.
No, I know. It's something that is difficult to think about. And I'm going to take that opportunity to circle back to my movie, since my movie Late for My Mother's Funeral is about the departure of an extremely powerful woman, a matrilineal kind of control, and most of her offspring who are female, and so that I really got to know female members of the Islamic culture really well. It was pretty interesting to watch all of that, and it of course became pretty much the central in my movie. One of the things that happens, when all of these people go into their mourning is they want to figure out they are obsessed with figuring out what to do with the youngest daughter, Suad, who had remained at her mother's side until her mother's death, not just taking care of her, but living with her until she was 35 years old, which is really what old maid territory in Islamic culture. And so now the movie then turns to that issue and what is going to become of Suad. And she is in the movie is pressured to be married, largely because the family members did not want her on their backs. They didn't want to be taking care of her. And that was just fascinating to me to observe and to film so up close, and also very painful, to say the least, very painful, because I'm kind of close to Suad by now, and I see the limitations of her choices. Her choices are very limited, and I think illustrating that in my film is a good thing for people to see.
Well, but you're not, and I know how difficult this is, but you're not really embracing my question, which is, what is the fate of women in terms of equality? Political equality, social equality, economic equality in this world dominated by an Islamic orientation.
Well, it was interesting that after the Algerian independence, a form of government was installed in Algeria that really took, it wasn't something that didn't work. It did work for a long time. And it was, basically sort of communist and very, very supported and aided by Russia. But one of the policies, women were represented fully in every way in the culture. And it was a huge emancipation for women. And it was a real separation from Islam, actually, because the values were very different, and it was very successful, and it continues to this day to a certain extent, and that's an interesting case study that and as well as Iraq was a pretty interesting case study mm-hmm. in that same way, because it also had a great deal of success in providing equal opportunity for women and equal education, as did Libya. And so those things are quite possible, but it takes a powerful upheaval or a powerful leader even who has those values to make that happen. In at least those two cases, in Libya and in Iraq, we assassinated those leaders.
In fact, we have a history in Africa and in the Middle East of assassination and engaging in a kind of covert war to achieve what I consider rather nebulous nationalist goals.
Right. Well, yes, the United States, it's the Western powers in general, it's an accord between several powers, do have that history. It's true. And you have to ask, did anyone have that point of view during the negotiations? Was it only, neocons and people like that? Who were making all the decisions? Well, I haven't got the answer to that one, but
no, and I think it is. I mean, I really, one of the things that your film did for me was to open up, in my mind, a serious dialogue. I hope I don't sound too schizophrenic here, but a serious dialogue about what constitutes progress and what constitutes liberation in the cultural context of someplace other than the West and other than the United States.
Well, good. That's a marvelous thing for you to say. And I guess I'll have to agree with you. I think it does open up all kinds of questions. And one of the ironies of the movie is that here we had a mother who was extremely liberated, very dominant, and very successful and powerful. She was a powerful caída, a ruler of her area, and kind of a bandit in Western Algeria. A great model, I would say, kind of a Western model. And she created daughters who had those goals. And yet, after she was gone, everyone, ironically, just wanted to marry Suad off. And you see that happening, and it does open up a dialogue. You're saying, but wait, how could this be? That sort of thing. And I think those things are extremely important. But that's also one of the ways that the movie is kind of universal, in the sense that it's not just about an Arab family. Because things like that happen in families, you know. As soon as there is the loss of the dominant parent, well, then all kinds of struggles take place that really had nothing to do with the mother's values.
We're here with Penny Allen, who is a citizen of France and a citizen of the United States and a filmmaker and an amazing artist. And I really think that what has happened to the United States in modern times, post-war, if you will, is an isolation, intellectual isolation. We don't know. Islam to us is not just a foreign religion. It is a threatening force. And we don't consider the various trends and factors in local nationalism, in the larger questions of the Sunni-Shia struggle, and in the impact of the fact of wealth in that region. None of this is really real to us. All we're doing is playing a geopolitical game, and we still have the putative enemies of the Soviet Union and China to play that game with.
But you know, that is one of my motivations in making this movie. I think that, like you, people in this country, in the United States, have an extremely superficial take on what Arab countries are like or what Islamic countries are like. And they, the bad rep given to those countries by Al-Qaeda and by other terrorist groups is what is retained. And how unfortunate. And what I really wanted to do was to make tell a story that where you look at it and you say, oh, it's a family just like us. You know, they're having the same fight we had and the same difficulties that we had after mom died. And I think it works in that way. And I think it's important to, you know, to have these kinds of experiences where you have an intimate contact with a situation or with an Islamic family that is not frightening at all.
So you're suggesting that what your film does is create an overarching sense of commonality and humanity.
I hope.
Yeah, no, and I agree. By the way, having seen the film, I saw it in an earlier cut, so I don't know what the final cut looks like. But having seen the film, I was very impressed by that, and I saw it as a universal story, which gives it a great power. But I'm forced to come back to the difference rather than the commonality. I think, for example, of Iran in this current world situation. The two modern, if you will, and I think you may disagree with me on this, the two modern powerful states in that part of the world have got to be Iran and Saudi Arabia. And yet Saudi Arabia is far more a tribal society and far more reactionary than Iran. But Iran is the enemy. Saudi Arabia, because of the historic value of its oil resources, I think, is our ally.
But you're leaving out the Emirates, which have now taken the dominant position financially, I would say, in the world. And, you know, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Dubai, Doha, those places are beyond our wildest imaginings in terms of their wealth and their power and their their draw. They are drawing in millions of people now to live there and to work there. And I don't know those cultures really well yet, and I hope to find out more about them. But I think that that is ultimately going to be a much more powerful force in that area than Saudi Arabia.
Well, when I think of Doha, of course, I immediately think of Al Jazeera, the broadcast networks. And as many of our listeners may know, and I'm sure you know, former Vice President of the United States, Al Gore, sold his interest in his cable channel to Al Jazeera. And now there is, from my point of view, an excellent news programming coming out of Doha, fairly objective, I think, far, far better than anything being broadcast in this nation, except maybe Amy Goodman, really dealing with the issues of the world.
Right, I agree with you, and because they're there, and because they know, and I must say that during the Arab Spring, which was in 2011 largely, and had continued on for a while, I watched Al Jazeera every day. That was my source, my primary source of information, and it's partly because it was raw, in the sense of, you know, somebody's there and they're telling you what is happening, and then perhaps somebody else would give an analysis, place it in context. But none of that stuff showed up in anything here, in any kind of news source here. But now you can watch Al Jazeera here. Well, I mean, even then you could watch it on your computer.
Right. When I want the news, because I'm a news junkie, I'll listen to CBS and NBC and so on, who are appalling. The stories get more and more lightweight, less and less informative year by year. Then I turn to Al Jazeera America, and I suddenly find news reporting that makes sense, that is germane, that shows a knowledge both of history and of geography. It's really impressive.
It is impressive. You know, and I have to say that the family in my movie, the Zuri family, they all watch Al Jazeera, and in Arabic, of course, but they watch it. And it's, it's the same programming content. It doesn't mean that it's different just because it's in Arabic. But so they're very informed, you know, about what's going on. And, they don't watch French news, for instance, because it's very much like what you were just talking about CBS and NBC. It's lightweight, and, you know, it doesn't have people on site.
Well, you know, so if I understand the arc of your argument, you're suggesting that power and knowledge both are shifting toward a world dominated by societies that have come out of the tradition of Islam rather than the tradition of Christianity or Judaism.
Right. But, you know, there's still the dominant part of Islam is what's the word for laïc in English? It's a sect.
Sexist?
No. Sectarian. It's sectarian. It's
non.
Yes, it's non. It is not extremist at all. And anyone can go look at comparisons between Christianity, the central values of Christianity, and the central values of Islam, of sectarian Islam, that is not extremist and has no desire to dominate. They're the same. They're identical. And that's pretty amazing. So it doesn't worry me. What worries me is political movements that cause the extremists to dominate and to influence and to encourage counter movements in the West.
Well, do you think the United States is ironically the enabler of these reactionary forces?
Yes.
Well, yes.
Yes, I do. I think that there was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq before the United States invaded Iraq. Now there is. And you can say that, you know, from one place to the next. You really can.
Well, how much of this distortion, I'm going to call it a distortion because I think if the natural ebb and flow of history were allowed to continue unabated, things would be very different. How much of this distortion really has to do with the very special place that Israel takes up in American policy?
Well, probably a lot. That's a pretty delicate subject.
It is. And it scares the hell out of me.
It's a less delicate subject in France. People do not hesitate to say what they think about that subject in France, whereas they do here. It's, you know, politically a hot potato. But I think that in Europe they have a much more realistic view of you know, how Israel at this time, because of Netanyahu, is encouraging an extremist reaction, and is taking an extremist position, and is not playing it the way he should be playing it at all. I think that one of the things that's really interesting, and you know, that I've really observed in the last 10 years at least, I don't know so much about it in this country, but I think so. Because it's certainly in the New York Times, there's suddenly an honest assessment of Israel's history and of the fact that they actually were hundreds of thousands of Palestinians living in that area that were moved out in order to create Israel, and other such facts like that. You know, now those facts are starting to be widely known, and people are they're gradually getting to understand why it is that the Palestinians could be so resentful. I don't think most Americans are really aware of the fact that the majority of Palestinians live in, What was it in South Africa? Bantustan, so, you know, and it's like Soweto, and it's apartheid.
So you would call it apartheid?
I would call it apartheid. They call it apartheid in France.
Well, and you know, for me, this is extremely very awkward. When I was a child, growing up in Southern California, what I learned was basically a propagandized view of Israel.
Well, we all did. And, they all did.
Yeah, and I remember the poster, the large billboards in the San Fernando Valley, Los Angeles, of a very handsome, powerful, muscled man with his somewhat diminutive but also powerful and muscled and very beautiful woman and their two children. The poster was all blue and white, and it spoke of Israel. This was at the point of the birth of Israel. And I remember reading various pieces that argued that this land of Palestine was underutilized, that it was basically ignorant peasants who did nothing of value, that it was a society that was very small in numbers, and that all left to have a war with Israel. Now I find out, in fact, that the policy of the various radical groups of pro-Zionists drove out of all of Palestine as much as they could any Arab communities. And, you know, the Palestinians were shoved out of their homeland. Now, the argument is often made, well, gee, but Lebanon, Syria, particularly Jordan, haven't helped these people by making them citizens. The assumption being that these Palestinians, since they have an Islamic cultural commonality with the Jordanians, should become a part of Jordan, for example.
Well, that's like saying, well, you know, shouldn't you Americans just, you know, make common cause with Canadians, become Canadian? You know, they're your neighbor. I mean, there's a difference between the peoples. You know, they were different groups, different tribes, different countries, and to say that is sort of, you know, it's naive. But not all those countries, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, all do have large Palestinian refugee populations, but they are refugees, and many of them live in camps. Most of them live in camps. When you say to take them in as citizens, that is not exactly what happened. And they have been maintained in camps for, what is it, since 1948?
Yeah.
Well.
So is that a political decision on the part of those nations? For geopolitical reasons, or is that a cultural difference?
It's a cultural difference, but also it's a question of resources. You know, right now, Jordan is just overrun with Syrian refugees, and they don't have the means to take care to absorb all of these people. You know, it's an economic problem. But yes, it's a cultural difference, but it's an economic problem.
And the same is true for southern Turkey as well. Now, into this mix, many people know this, but many may not. There are the Kurdish peoples whose traditions are very, very, though they are Islamic, their traditions are very, very different from any of the other so-called Arab peoples. And they exist as a potential nation state of Kurdistan.
Right. Yes. In Iraq, part of it in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Part of it in Turkey,
yes.
Part of it in Iran.
Well, I think now this takes you back to Yugoslavia was, where Yugoslavia managed to lump together different groups like this in different sub-states and to make it into a nation state that endured for quite some time successfully. And I think that's what you're looking at, you know, and you're talking about these sub-states that are lumped together in the Middle East, and sometimes it works, or it works for a while, and then it doesn't work. I don't think that the current situation, how Israel is, can last. It doesn't seem to me that it can last, and that probably the sooner that it is resolved peacefully into two separate countries, the better off we're all going to be over the world, especially in this country, because the United States is, of course, likely to become involved.
Yeah, one of the things that people may not realize is that the policy of the Israelis was to assassinate throughout North Africa any Palestinians who were modernists and liberals, and possibly the very people with whom one could negotiate a reasonable settlement. I think it left the most radical nationalists among the Palestinians still in power.
Yes, that is right. But a lot of one of the things that I do in Paris is go to this bookstore that has about once a month, it has some kind of a speaker coming from usually Palestine. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen all kinds of raw footage shot by people in Palestine, and also listen to people who, you know, whose voices are never heard in the larger picture. And I'm now aware of the fact that perhaps those people who are the most moderate, the most capable of negotiating something reasonable, are in prison. They're in prison by the Israelis.
If they're not dead, they're in prison.
Right. If they're not there, they're in prison. And really, just vast numbers. And maybe that's what you're saying, is that they wanted to put the people who were the most moderate in prison, because they would prefer to have it remain a hostile situation.
I'm afraid that may be true, and in this country it's particularly awkward. The United States is sometimes, I feel like, it's the tail is wagging the dog, that Israel is really defining our foreign policy to a tremendous extent. And that is troubling, because it also gives rise to a kind of unspoken but very real resentment of Israel, a kind of anti-Semitism that manifests itself in all kinds of odd ways.
Yes. No, I agree with that very much so. I happen to think it's changing, and gradually. And maybe I'm wrong, but I think it certainly is changing in Europe, and it's changing in France, and it would appear to be changing in the United States.
I want to change the subject for a minute and get back to both your film, Late for My Mother's Funeral, and to talk a little bit about North Africa, because to me, I know so little, and I'm so ignorant. I know that your film is about people who were just skirting the law, if not outside the law, in gaining whatever wealth they had. And I also know that the issue of being a citizen of Algeria versus a citizen of Morocco plays a major role in your film, as well as being a citizen of France.
Yes. Well, there has historically there's a long, dispute between Algeria and Morocco, and it's not that different from other kind of tribal disputes in Arab-dominated areas, and it goes back a long ways. In Algeria, for instance, they brought in Moroccan farm laborers 130 years ago, and because Algerians didn't want, or they needed additional labor, and Algerians didn't want to do that labor. Does it sound like someplace else?
Well, it sounds very,
very familiar.
Very familiar,
yes. Anyway, the Moroccans were kind of an inferior race in Algeria. And there have been multiple disputes and hostile declarations between the countries, and also multiple deportations of citizens from one country to the other. Moroccans in Algeria were sent back to Morocco, even though they'd never been there, and vice versa. And the family in my movie in 1975 was deported from Algeria into Morocco, and all of them. And they stayed varying amounts of time, from one day. The shortest was the person who snuck back in one day. Others, everyone was back within, 4 or 5 months, and having snuck across the border. And once they were there, and then this kind of power that the woman had came into force, where everyone is sort of paid off, so that they were allowed to stay there, and no one. That's how that functioned in that culture. But that, yes, it's important because it. It certainly the main character in the movie is actually a guy, Abdel Jalil, and he suffered from that deportation and from that inferior being treated as an inferior all of his life. For an example, the French gave the last name of SNP sans nom patronymique, without a father's name, to all Moroccans living in Algeria. And so in school, when they called the roll, they would say SNP Abdel Jalil, so he has to answer to that non-name all of his childhood. Anyway, he grew up resenting that a great deal. Not all of the members of the family did, other ones were zen about it, but he was very he felt very strongly about it. And yes, so it's an important part. But that's when I say the influence of political events on people, events that really have nothing to do with them personally. It's important, those kinds of repressions and oppressions are terribly important.
And the fact that the family's fortune, such as it was, really rested on smuggling.
Yes, and it rested on the fact that gold and emeralds and other precious jewels were available in Morocco, always were. And they were not allowed in post-liberation Algeria. They were considered, something that would cause inequality amongst people. Of course, they do. And nevertheless, that Zineb became a smuggler, going to Morocco and herself, and getting the product, and then coming back, and then selling it herself in the Kasbah, and then eventually she developed a huge network of women who did all of that kind of work for her, and she just sort of directed the whole thing, and kept it safe, with bakshish, paying off the authorities. So that's, it's an interesting way that women got their power in that country. And it's like the West. It's like the far west of the United States, the Western history. And it is the far west, as a matter of fact, of Algeria.
Right. And I think it, so again, we come round to the question that I raised earlier. In an Islamic world, how do women gain the same kinds of power and the same significance in society as men have?
Well, it depends on that culture. You know, as I said, it depends on the where you are. You know, that women are much closer to equality in Algeria than they are in a number of other Islamic countries. And that might be partly because so far, you know, it's a fairly moderate version of Islam that is in control in Algeria.
You know, and that raises an important point, which I think Americans see Islam. First of all, they don't, or they're just beginning to learn the difference between the two major sects of Islam. And second of all, they tend to see the Islamic world as if it were the old caliphate, which was never as united as it pretended to be historically. That is to say that everybody was following the same faith, that everybody had the same nationalist objectives and goals.
Yes, well, it's a you know, a simplistic view on the whole thing, and I think, you know, there are Islamic cultures where there are still harems, and you know, those are certainly not equal forms. But then they do not exist in modern states. They certainly don't. I mean, they don't exist in most countries in the Middle East.
Well, let me ask you, what do you think the fate of Saudi Arabia will be in this new world?
I don't know. I'm finally going to say I don't know. I don't know. I don't. I guess I don't follow.
Mentioned the significance of the Emirates in all of this, and Saudi Arabia is the big landmass country.
But Saudi Arabia is a closed culture, and they keep a tight rein on everything, and you can't immigrate to Saudi Arabia unless you're a slave or a contract worker.
Yeah,
and that is not necessarily the case in the Emirates, and there are plenty of contract workers and quote slaves and being brought into the Emirates, but for the most part, it's people with master's degrees who are coming there from Great Britain and who are finding great success in their lives. You know, it is not a closed society, and so that is one reason why I think they will outstrip Saudi Arabia.
Well, and Saudi Arabia has this enormous rivalry based more, I think, on religion than anything else with Iran.
Right. I don't know. I mean, right at the moment, you know, Saudi Arabia is sort of playing. It's unclear what they're doing because they don't seem to be functioning very much as an ally of the United States. You know, they're taking some different positions, mm-hmm. and in Iran and maybe Israel as well. And they do not seem to be functioning as an ally to other countries where they have been traditionally an ally. So I would have to say that I don't know what's going on there. You know, and I think maybe you have to watch Al Jazeera when they give you a Saudi Arabia special, then we'll find out.
Yeah. Well, I want to come back. Just we're coming toward the end of our interview. I want to come back to your movie because I think it's a very important document. And I hope that people will see it and will read it as an example of the complexity of the relationships that exist in North Africa and the relationships between North Africa and Europe.
I hope so, too. But it's also very accessible, I think. And,
Universal, I would say.
Right. But it's quite accessible in the sense that it's, these people are funny and they're kind of entertaining and the situations that they get into in the movie. Are interesting, and so it's really about them. It's an intimate, turbulent portrait of this family. As you said, you can look at it as a universal story in two ways: one as a family story, but also of Islamic cultures.
Do you feel it's going to be well received in the United States? Do you have any sense of
it? I don't
that?
Have any sense of it. The movie was selected for the Montreal World Film Festival, and I had no idea what to expect. You know, the first screening I went to, I thought maybe there'll be 10 people there, and it was sold out, and it was sold out for every screening. And it was terribly well received. It was really wonderful, and I got good reviews and lots of good follow-up. And, you know, the film has been invited to other film festivals as a result. Including the International Film Festival in Beijing.
Beijing, wow. Well, Penny Allen, I want to really thank you for giving us your time, and I want to praise our station, KBOO, for having you on for this length of time to talk both about your film and about what you know about the situation in North Africa and in the Islamic world in general. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
That was host Joe Uris speaking with filmmaker and former Portlander Penny Allen about her latest film, Late to My Mother's Funeral, and about European and North African politics. Penny Allen's film, Late to My Mother's Funeral, screens at 7 p.m. this Monday, December 16th at the Witzel Auditorium at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. This is KBOO Portland, where the time is approximately 10.01 a.m., Coming up, Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints features the latest on protests of the police killing of teen Andy Lopez in Santa Rosa, California. And at 11, on the Digital Divide, host Rabia Yeaman speaks with Kelly Roy, director, and Seamus Hawley, shop master at ADX, where high-profile designers work alongside students and retirees and share their knowledge. Yes. And it's the KBOO members that support KBOO Community Radio. If you are not a member, why not? You know, it's possible that you could go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today to become a member. You can make that leap from passive listener to active supporter. Stay tuned, won't you? Thank you.